Happy National Deoxyribonucleic Acid Day, a celebration of two discoveries regarding the genetic material that is at the very heart of who we are and of all life on Earth. So we thought that today's edition of Please Explain would be a good time to talk about DNA. Dr. Timothy Bester, professor of genetics and development at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University Medical Center, joins me now. Along with Dr. Brian McCabe, Columbia University Assistant Professor of Physiology and Cellular Biophysics at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University. My DNA is acting up right now. Thank you both for stopping by. Dr. Bester, for those in the audience who are unaware that this is National DNA Day, why April 25th? Is there a special significance? Is this the day that Watson and Crick announced?
No, not to my knowledge. The National Human Genome Research Institute announced that this was National DNA Day.
That's it. They just chose this day.
As far as I know.
Okay. Well, it's been with us for a while now. So how much do we know about DNA now? Have we pretty much figured it all out?
Oh, no, not at all. There's about 3 billion nucleotides of genome in the human of DNA in the human genome that stretches about each cell contains about 2 meters of this. The DNA in a single human body would stretch from here to the moon several times. Of that,
you mean my DNA goes 2 meters
per cell, and you have about 10 to the 12th or a trillion, several trillion cells in your body. So there's many millions of miles of DNA in a human body.
And these are polymers. Last week we were talking about plastic as polymers. These are another form of polymer.
Yeah, much more complex, and the order of the nucleotides is actually informational. So the order of nucleotides in DNA determines the order of amino acids and proteins. And the function of the protein, of course, is a function of the function of the protein is determined by the sequence of amino acids.
Dr. McCabe, what were some of the earlier developments and discoveries that pointed scientists toward DNA as our genetic material?
Well, we can be quite proud as New Yorkers that many of the key discoveries on DNA were actually made here in Manhattan. After Gregor Mendel had elucidated the laws of genetics, Thomas Hunt Morgan in 1913 at Columbia University show that genes lie together in a linear sequence along a chromosome. But one of the key experiments that really show that DNA is a hereditary material were done by Oswald Avery and his colleagues at Rockefeller University on the Upper East Side. And what Avery showed was, at the time, many people believed that proteins, that, as Tim mentioned, DNA is a rather simple molecule, at least in its basis, and many people thought that it was too simple to be the hereditary material. But what Avery showed was that actually he could inherit from one species of bacteria to another, one strain of bacteria to another using DNA. So that really proved that DNA was a genetic material. And then subsequently to that, another Columbia University scientist, Erwin Shargraf, showed that the ratios of bases in DNA are approximately equal. And that was an important discovery that set up the subsequent helical structure of DNA that was elucidated by Watson and Crick.
But if you ask most people about DNA, they say Watson and Crick as though that's where it began. They were the ones who, everybody else knew that something was there, but they're the ones who figured out how it actually worked?
They discovered that DNA is self-complementary, such that, in their famous phrase, it has not escaped our attention that the structure that will be proposed immediately suggests a mechanism for the replication of the genetic material. So the two strands of DNA can be separated, and an enzyme called DNA polymerase will lay down the sequence of complementary bases on each to form two daughter DNA duplexes. And I should add one other thing. There was a Columbia medical student named Sutton who even earlier proposed that genes were on chromosomes. And then it was Morgan a few years later that showed that they're on chromosomes and in a fixed order. So New York City has a very distinguished history in DNA and genetics.
Did we need to understand the double helix to understand that there was a thing called RNA as well? Or was that already kind of...
Well, that came subsequently. So RNA the RNA is a molecule that is intermediate between DNA and protein. So DNA doesn't make protein directly. It uses an intermediate molecule called RNA, usually called messenger RNA, that subsequently is used as a template to make the proteins. So that was...
And they line up according to the way the DNA is lined up.
That's correct. And so the RNA is then converted into protein using a number of different processes, an RNA polymerase and what are called transfer RNAs.
Does DNA work differently in plants than it does in animals?
No, we think that DNA works very similar in plants and animals. And in fact, if you compare the code which converts DNA to proteins between plants and animals, it's almost identical. So what the progenitor for both plants and animals seem to have already worked out this DNA RNA protein code in our long distance ancestors.
I am informed that today is DNA Day because it is the anniversary of the publication of the paper that revealed the discovery of the double helix structure of DNA in 1953. So, and then the announcement of the mapping of the human genome was also done on this day. I guess they waited until April 25th because of the significance of the first discovery. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We are talking about DNA and not only how it is the building block of life, but how it connects all living things on Earth and also how it has changed the way we can determine all sorts of things. It's been in the news recently because of the fundamentalist Mormon group that... where there are a lot of confusions about who's parent, and DNA now can resolve that. In the past, it would have been a lot more complicated. My guests are Drs. Timothy Bestor and Brian McCabe, and later we will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692 if you want to join in the discussion here on WNYC, WNYC.org. So, when we talk about the human genome, we're talking about something that's very similar to the genomes of other mammals. We're always told that chimpanzees and humans share, 98% of?
It's 99.2% sequence identity.
But vive la difference. Just that 0.8% is what differentiates us from chimpanzees?
Yes.
And we're so different, aren't we? Or are we so similar?
Well, I think it may be that even among those differences, there are not so many that are important. What seems to be very important is how genes are expressed and when they're expressed over development of an animal. So in addition to providing an instruction manual about how to build an animal, the DNA sequence also provides a timing of when this gene should be expressed or that gene should be expressed. And how those genes interact with each other can have very different outcomes, even though they look rather similar when you look at their basic sequence.
What do we learn when we compare the human genome to other genomes that have been mapped, like dogs?
Well, there have been a lot of genomes mapped, plants, as we have mentioned, bacteria, fruit flies, C. elegans, and so on. And what's rather humbling for us is to see how similar we are to other animals. Maybe humbling and maybe ennobling, too.
I mean, similar to fruit flies.
For example, fruit flies, which are my favorite organism, the organism we use in our lab, if you look at diseases, genes which, when disrupted, cause human disease, fruit flies have 70% of those genes. So next time you swap one with a newspaper from your banana, remember that it's not such a distant relation under the skin at the molecular level.
I'm already feeling guilty. What is meant by the term genetic engineering? Are portions of the DNA actually replaced by other portions of the DNA?
What it usually means is that you make a transgenic animal or plant by direct introduction of a segment of DNA, which then integrates usually randomly into the host species. So corn has been made resistant to bacteria by injection of a protein encoded by a bacterium that makes them resistant to infection by other organisms. That genetic engineering is it's it's kind of a misleading term because it implies that we can go in and engineer, that we can account for all aspects of the system. And, of course, that's not at all true.
It leads to the idea that you could take a certain portion of DNA out of a human, a bad portion of DNA, and stick in a good one.
In mice, you can do that to some extent. In humans, the technology simply doesn't exist now.
Mm-hmm. How is this related to stem cell research? Are there connections between the two?
As you suggested, that one of the things, if you have a mutant gene, for example, in cystic fibrosis patients, they have a gene in the cystic fibrosis gene, that perhaps you could replace that in a stem cell and then use those stem cells derived from your own body to replace those cells in your body. But I think that's still a little bit far off, and attempts that have been made for directly, for example, putting viruses or to change your DNA have not been successful so far. So there may be technological limits to it, but we really don't know yet all of the problems that would be the case. But it seems at least it should be a hopeful technology, and it seems like at least conceptually it should be a good idea. But again, we're not there at the point yet where we can use it in practice.
Isn't one of the problems that you can also, this is also a way to introduce cancer to a body? I mean, unless you
especially with virus-based gene therapy vectors. In the one case where you successfully treated a case of severe combined immunodeficiency, several of the patients came down with leukemia. The virus is integrated into the genome at a place that dysregulated adjacent genes and actually caused the leukemia.
Recently, there have been news stories about people learning the details of their own personal genome. How frequently is that being done?
So currently, there are two people who have their own genomes publicly available, Craig Venter and most recently Jim Watson's genome was sequenced.
So two of the key figures in this story both did it.
Yes. So Watson was sequenced by someone else, and Craig Venter actually sequenced his own genome and made it publicly available. What was impressive about the recent Watson sequencing was that it was done in less than a month and it cost less than $1 million. Now, that's still quite expensive, but versus what it cost to originally sequence the human genome, it's an order of magnitude less. So it suggests that sequencing technology is getting faster and cheaper, and so that perhaps in someday not too far and far away, we may be able to actually have all of our own personal genome sequenced.
And what would we be able to use that for? I mean, James Watson still made a really stupid statement in a recent interview. Would we go in there and take a couple of little things out of his genome and put in some smarter thoughts?
Well, I wouldn't like to comment as a geneticist too harshly on Jim.
Well, he's been here many times, and we've always had interesting conversations, but he's never said anything as outrageous as the thing that he said that got him in so much trouble.
Well, we can't, I think, blame his DNA on that. Perhaps he needs to use his brain a little bit more carefully on some of those statements. But what we could use the genome is to, for example, see if we have every one of us has mutations in particular genes, and they give us a propensity to disease. So if you knew, for example, that you were likely to get prostate cancer or breast cancer, you might go more frequently to be screened for those diseases. And so it could be very beneficial for you to have that information.
And there's been resistance until now because people were concerned about insurance. Congress, I think, is voting today on I think the Senate already passed it yesterday, and I think maybe the House is doing it today, on a bill that will not allow insurance companies to use that information against us.
It seems to me like the unreasonable search and seizure amendment applies perfectly here. Someone has no control whatsoever as to their DNA sequence, and they should not be, each insurance company should not have access to that information. There's a related ethical point. Recently, people have been using the claim that they're genetically predisposed to violence and using this as a defense at their trials. However, the more logical response would be if someone's genetically predisposed to violence, they should be not acquitted, but given a longer term than a person not using that defense.
But the bill currently before Congress is, and which has passed, I think, and President Bush has said he will sign it, is specifically to avoid your insurance companies, for example, changing your premiums if you do have your DNA sequence and you discover that you have a presence of disease, and also for employers not to use it for discrimination, for promotions or hiring and so forth. So that information should be personal to you that you can use for your own health care and benefits, but should not be used by others to discriminate or perhaps to, in the opposite case, promote you over others.
DNA testing has been in the news for all sorts of different reasons. It determines paternity and maternity. It can determine whether a person committed a crime. How do those tests work? I mean, in some cases, they find very little bit of information, and yet they are able to decide whether a person was involved in a sexual crime or not, or even was in a room at a certain time.
Yeah, in the 80s, a scientist in England named Alec Jeffries found that people differed about one out of each 1,000 nucleotides. And since there's 3 billion nucleotides, 3 billion nucleotides, people on average will differ to about 3 million positions. This means this gives you an enormously high discriminative power. You can reliably identify whether. So, for example, in a case of disputed paternity, the single nucleotide polymorphisms, as these sequence differences are called, if half of those in the father should be present in the offspring whose paternity is disputed, and because there's so many of them. You can get with the right statistical procedures, and provided that the current technology is employed correctly, you can get a very authoritative answer.
Although in the O.J. Simpson case, it was still called into question.
The lawyers called it into question the science was not wrong. I mean, Simpson's blood was on the murder victim, and the murder victim's blood was on Simpson. There's no doubt about that.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. We're talking about DNA on today's Please Explain. It is DNA, National DNA Day, and my guests are two doctors, Timothy Bester, Professor of Genetics and Development at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University Medical Center, and Dr. Brian McCabe, Assistant Professor of Physiology and Cellular Biophysics at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia. Our number again, 212-433-9692. We're back with Please Explain, talking about DNA on National DNA Day with Dr. Timothy Bester and Dr. Brian McCabe, both connected with Columbia University, which has played such a major role in the DNA story over the years, although Cambridge came up with the big one. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Before we get to the calls, just can you explain what's probably going on right now in El Dorado, Texas, in regard to this case with the children who were taken out of the FLDS compound?
Well, as Tim outlined before the break, they're using DNA fingerprinting technology to identify parents contributed DNA to the children. And so because everyone has a unique DNA profile, by studying enough of these different polymorphic sites, you can determine that this person was the father of this child or this person, which I guess is easier to determine, is the mother of this child. And so I guess what they're doing right now is using this to figure out the parenthood of this the children involved.
Now, I'm still a little confused. We have two parents, and so I have my genome map. The woman has a different one, and the child would be a combination. So how would we know which is mine and which is hers?
Children are provided with half of your DNA, one of each chromosome, and a half of the female DNA. So, and we have two copies, two chromosomes of in each person. So your chromosomes are unique, and so we can determine by using the statistical methods and the number of polymorphisms that they came from either parent. Mm-hmm. So by looking at a large number of loci, we can determine that.
Should we take some calls? Our number is 212-433-9692. Paul from Long Island, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Love your show. What I wanted to ask is, I think they're called prions, the stuff that causes mad cow disease, and how does that differ from normal stuff? Does it have DNA and things of that sort?
No, the whole point of prion disease is that they do not involve DNA, but rather a heritable alternative conformation of a protein. The radical aspect of the prion hypothesis was that there's inheritance in the absence of any nucleic acid.
Yeah.
That's quite a rare disease, especially in humans, the bovine spongiform encephalopathy. And it's not at all clear that prions have a role in normal human development, that protein-based inheritance has any role in normal human biology.
But that would suggest that there is life without DNA.
These
or are they not living?
They're not living by any means. They're parasitic.
They need
a host
DNA to become alive.
And there are many viruses, for example, which don't have DNA. They just have RNA. And so they function completely in the RNA, using the RNA molecule. So what was really striking about the prion, when I was an undergraduate, we learned DNA makes RNA, makes protein. And that was the way it always worked. But, of course, it turns, in some cases, RNA can make DNA. And as Tim just outlined, protein itself, in these rare cases, can be inheritable. So it was quite a paradigm shift.
Well, it makes sense to me that if DNA can make RNA, then RNA could ultimately come up with the mirror of DNA.
Well, perhaps you should be working in molecular biology 20 years ago, because for a lot of people, the dogma was...
I've always been 20 years too late.
The dogma was that it only went one way, and so finding that it could actually go the other way was a major discovery.
Mary from the West Village, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was just wondering how the lawyers in the O.J. Simpson case were able to shed doubt on O.J. Simpson's DNA, which was found on the victim.
Yeah, there was a number of ways. In one case, they accused the forensics unit of the police of substituting O.J. Simpson's blood for someone else's. If you remember, there was a blue cap tube which was supposed to contain, I think, 36 mLs, and it was found to contain 34 milliliters. But
right.
These blue cap tubes are not meant as measuring devices; they're very approximate. But they were able to sow doubt in the jury's mind by the use of things like that. I don't think this is at all unusual in cases like this.
Thank you for calling. Well, it worked in that case to
yes.
sow doubt.
Yes.
Gary from Belmar, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air. Gary, you there?
I'm here. Maybe this is a little far out in the future, but, you know, I note that industrial companies have the ability to patent seeds, and apparently they've done some genetic modification. My question is, when the day comes that, say, the gene to cure cancer across the human race becomes available, it comes from somewhere. Does that become property, or is what happens then? Is that part of the human gene pool, or does this become something that...
Well, but before you answer, could there be a gene to cure cancer?
Well,
no, I'm not asking you. I'm asking my guests.
Well, that was actually the theme of a very recent movie, I Am Legend. Mm-hmm. It invented a virus that cured cancer. Of course, it turned everyone into a zombie. But the question you ask is a legal...
I thought it was just bad acting.
is a legal issue, really, and we're scientists. So how this will play out is hard to imagine.
Well, but it's interesting to ask scientists, because in the end, scientists are patenting things that they discover, aren't they? The legal system in this country allows for all sorts of things that scientists might not be able to do in other countries.
Yeah, the Bayh-Dole Act actually encourages American scientists to commercialize their discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But then we have the problem, and we've seen this, where people discover that genetic material taken from them is being used in a vaccine, and they're not getting any of the money, and yet they are the supplier. So, but that's a whole other show, right?
Well, I think that's a complicated issue about patenting of genetic material and how who owns, for example, human genes. It's been quite debatable for many, as you say, as the caller points out, genes and particular sequences have been patented. But it's still, I think, an issue that's complicated and maybe above our pay grade, Dim.
We have a caller named Heather from Chester, New York. Hi, Heather, you're on the air.
Hi. My question was, I wondered about the validity of the stolen X-ray crystallograph from Rosalind Franklin, and that's how Watson Crick launched himself.
Was it stolen?
That's what I heard.
Well, I don't think it was stolen, but they did look at that crystallograph, and it did point to particular features of the DNA molecule that, when they subsequently built their model, may have helped them. And I think if you read autobiography by Jim Watson, he does. And the contribution of Rosalind Franklin to that structure has been made. I mean, as we pointed out earlier, there were many other people who made important contributions that eventually came up with that sequence, the double helix. But Rosalind Franklin's, I think, contribution has been increasingly appreciated, including by Jim Watson.
And there's an argument that the reason she didn't win a Nobel was because she was dead at the time, and they don't give Nobels posthumously.
I was going to bring that point up. Her data did indicate a helical structure for DNA, which was essential for the model. But had she lived, I think there's little doubt that she would have shared the Nobel Prize.
We go now to Jean from Manhattan. Hi, Jean.
Hi. My question is, in the Texas case that they're handling now, in the children, can their genes be confused among the siblings of the possible parents? I don't know if that question is clear.
Not really, because each child inherits a half of their genes. Each child inherits half of their genes from each parent, but it's a random half. Each polymorphism should be shared with either the mother or the father, but they assort independently at meiosis such that two sibs will never have exactly the same pattern of polymorphisms.
I see.
Thank you for calling us.
So the only people with identical genetic DNA sequence would be identical twins.
Now, they're identical, and yet their fingerprints are different. Why would that be?
Well, as development happens, they are identical on the genetic sequence, but as development happens, things randomly change. So fingerprints, for example, develop by changes in the surface of your fingers and in the way the cells develop. Of course, their brains will be developed. And if you know any identical twins, you'll say they often have quite different personalities, and that's because their brains have developed differently.
Yeah, and it's important to note that identical twins show about 40% discordance for major disorders such as schizophrenia and major depression. They're genetically identical, and yet they can be develop quite differently.
So this
more
is...
There's more than the DNA.
So there's the environmental factor, even with... there are some people who'd like to believe that that nature is the sole reason we are what we are, but there really is a nature and nurture divide here.
It could be purely stochastic or random, because identical twins typically have very different, very similar environments. So it's very hard to explain why they're so often discordant for these major developmental abnormalities.
But I think the sort of divide between nature and nurture, which is often mentioned, is an artificial one, because our nature, for example, if you have a propensity to lung cancer but you never smoke cigarettes, for example, you won't have that chance. So your nature, your DNA may give you an increased likelihood of developing something, but often things from the environment, from your nature, will be required to express that.
And there are some illnesses that are triggered by environmental things, like diabetes in some people, aren't there? You can have a propensity toward diabetes, but not actually wind up with it because you haven't had it triggered. And the next person has it triggered.
Right, and so one example is, for example, from the film *The Madness of King George*. King George was thought to have a dietary effect in a disease called PKU. If he hadn't eaten that particular food, given him the phenotype that he got.
Jessica from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have two questions, actually. My first question is, I know that red blood cells don't contain a nucleus, and therefore they wouldn't have any DNA inside of them. So I'm wondering how someone can have their blood tested for genetic information. And my second question is, I've heard about the BRAC home testing kit to determine whether or not someone has susceptibility for breast cancer. And I'm wondering how you feel about home testing and a person's ability to conduct this test at home on their own.
Yeah, first, the answer to the first question is the white blood cells that are in blood do have DNA.
Oh,
and
true.
It's that DNA that you recover. Actually, these days, genetic testing is often done by swabbing the inside of the mouth, and that removes enough epithelial cells to get DNA for testing. That, of course, is almost completely non-invasive. The second question, there's a gene called BRCA1, which in its mutated form has a very strong predisposition to cancer. And there's been tests available for several years, and I think most people are appalled because the counseling you receive in the event of a positive test is usually over the telephone. I think that a professional medical people should be involved.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Stephanie from Westchester. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very good. I first just want to say this is an absolute great show. I'm 20 years old, and I think that we're living in such an amazing time. We have so much science, so many interesting discoveries, and all the callers have asked questions that are really great lead up into my question. And it is, well, you were just talking about how Congress today is deciding on what to do and protecting people against the information that could be used with coding their genome. Well, how important is it that politicians, congressmen, and society as a whole becomes scientifically literate so we can learn to appreciate these new discoveries?
I think it's absolutely essential, as Leonard was just pointing out, to understand what's happening in cases like in Texas, but also to understand our own human biology and decisions we're going to make. And for example, stem cells and other scientific breakthroughs come forward, we need to be scientifically literate. The public needs to understand this. These decisions can't be made by scientists alone. They need to be made by the public in general. And having been informed about this is essential for us to be able to make good decisions about the way to go forward.
Stephanie, you might want to check out Rockefeller University, which is having a panel discussion on just this matter next Tuesday. I know about it because I'll be the moderator. Thank you for bringing the topic up.
Thank you.
Amy from Manhattan, hi. I think you're our last caller.
Oh, okay. I have a question about genetic modification, and I guess it applies to gene therapy as well. When a gene sequence is inserted for either of those purposes, can they these days select where it's going to go? Because I know that if it ends up in the wrong place or even is inverted,
trouble.
This is something I think about a lot, and I came up with an analogy. So you have a bad pipe in your house, and the plumber loads up a cannon with pipe of the right size and shoots it into the house. The chance that the pipe will actually repair the problem is very low, and that's a problem we face with genetic engineering. How do you make sure that the modified cells go to the correct locations where they can say repopulate damaged heart tissue? Right now, we don't have any way to do that.
But we can do it with other things. Why can we do it with corn and not with humans?
Well, if a corn plant is sick, it's just killed.
No, but I mean we can put a fish gene into the corn genome, and we wound up with something that's resistant to something. But, you know, we've heard of that sort of.
So the reason that we can do that is because with corn or fruit flies or nematodes, we can do large numbers of selection to find exactly the right one where it worked. Uh-huh. But you can't do that with people. You have a one person, one disease to cure, so you need to get it right the first time. A lot of the genetic manipulations we do, we can get it wrong a million times, but as once we get it right once, then we can pick that one. And that's the advantage of using model organisms.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Brian McCabe is Columbia University Assistant Professor of Physiology and Cellular Biophysics at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University. Timothy Bester is Professor of Genetics and Development at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University Medical Center. It's been fascinating.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Leonard.